We're here at New Valencia Hall in San Francisco. I'm with two representatives, and I'm also in the coalition, BACOR, Bay Area Coalition for Our Reproductive Rights, getting ready for a celebration and counter-demonstration to the 7th annual Walk for Life, where we're going to see thousands upon thousands of church-based activists bust in a well-organized and highly effective lobby to outlaw abortion across the United States, and until that's done, do everything they can to obstruct it. And we're going to go ahead and have a detailed discussion about the issues at hand and also the organizing for the action that's going to take place. Introduce yourselves and also talk a little bit about how BACOR came about and what BACOR is doing.
Sure. Hi, my name is Summer, and I am an organizer with BACOR. I've been with BACOR for about 3 years. And BACOR started in the late 80s as a response to Operation Rescue and the harassment that abortion clinics and, you know, reproductive rights clinics were getting from these people who are anti-choice and definitely not for supporting women. They provided a lot of support to clinics. And since then, our focus has shifted to putting on this counter-demonstration and pro-choice celebration in response to the anti-choice Walk for Life. Hi there, my name is Emily, and I am also an organizer with BACOR. I just got involved this year. I'd been to the demonstrations in the past, but I just got involved with organizing this year. And we're twins, so our voices sound practically identical.
Yeah. All right, they can't see you through the recording.
Yeah.
Okay, now, 2 years ago, there was a really insulting article in the Chronicle before this event, C.W. Nevius, I think it was, with a continued refrain that both sides are irrelevant, that nobody's listening to them, and that the march in the street doesn't mean anything. Now, one thing that I can say for a fact, I don't know who's listening to the far left, but the anti-abortion forces are quite effective and with brutal levels of effectiveness. Let's look at 2010. I read somewhere that there were 370 state-level bills put up that were anti-abortion in nature. I don't know how many passed, but I have a score sheet here which has a 10-page grid, 40 overall categories of legislation. I would say 38 out of the 40 are anti-abortion, and the other two are trivial reporting requirements. But the 40 different categories of types of anti-abortion legislation that was passed, and at the federal level, President Obama reportedly campaigned on repealing the Hyde Act, which bans abortions for low-income people, including people with disabilities that are on publicly funded Medicaid and Medicare programs. But not only didn't he touch that, but as a compromise to getting this dubious health care plan out, basically set the stage for banning it across the board for private insurance policies, and then later on signed an order to ban it on the two insurance exchanges that they had claimed were not in the bill but were snuck in the bill to give people public choices to the private plan. So it's an all-out assault on abortion legislation, and I've got a few of them here.
It really is. I think a lot of people were excited to see changes in coverage for birth control and, you know, women getting access for their actual reproductive health. But the flip side of that is that abortion access has been severely restricted with this health care bill and with all the bills that have passed this past year. Spot on.
Let's pick out a couple of them. Strict abortion measures enacted in Oklahoma. This was April 2010. The Oklahoma legislature voted to override the governor's vetoes on two abortion measures, one which requires women to undergo an ultrasound and listen to a detailed description of the fetus before getting an abortion, and the other one, no exceptions for rape or incest. And the second measure that was passed prevents women who have had a disabled baby from suing a doctor for withholding information about birth defects while the child was in the womb. The Democratic governor, Brad Henry, vetoed both bills, saying that the ultrasound law was flawed because it did not exempt rape and incest victims and would allow an unconstitutional intrusion into a woman's privacy. And the other measure, in that it was unconscionable to grant a physician legal protection to mislead or misinform pregnant women in an effort to impose his or her personal beliefs on a patient, but the Republican legislature overturned that. Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi have passed laws in recent years requiring women to undergo an ultrasound before having an abortion, and there were, in some of these states, they're not forced to do it, but there's a provision allowing it to be done. And in Kansas, this one more recently, posted December 30th, so right now really, Kansas lawmakers plan to consider legislation modeled on a new Nebraska law that restricts late-term abortions based on the claim that fetuses can feel pain after 20 weeks. This is the earliest stage of outlawing abortions for these reasons across the country. Lawmakers in Indiana, Iowa, and Kentucky have been drafting similar bills to Nebraska's law. Abortion critics hail Nebraska's law as the most prominent and promising outcome of a 5-4 Supreme Court decision in the 2007 case. The decision turned away a challenge to the federal ban on partial birth abortion, in other words, upholding the right to make legislation against that. In other words, if you don't get it really fast, you can't have it.
Yeah.
And the other thing we had was, we'll pass on going into details on it. It was some stuff on the federal bill, but talk about all that.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, I mean, that clearly illustrates that what we're doing is incredibly relevant to women and people in America right now. We're seeing, yeah, just a lot of restriction on access to abortion and funding for abortion as well. And it's kind of wild because no matter really how much people try to prevent women from having abortions, women will always have abortions. And the Guttmacher Institute, they did a study where they found that in countries where abortion is highly restrictive or in areas where abortion is legal, the rates are very similar. So honestly, all of these laws, all they do is make it incredibly challenging for women to have abortions. Women have a legal right to have an abortion if they choose. So all of these challenges to access, to availability, these really do not follow the Constitution. They don't follow women's the Bill of Rights for Women. And so that's why we're out there really advocating that women have safe, available access.
Okay, great. There's a few more in this pile of things where the federal ban are moving on to the state. Five states created bans or limits on abortion coverage in the state insurance exchanges, just like the federal ones did. And there's one, Arizona, which actually limits abortion now in the state workers' employee plan. So we have a wonderful scenario where both parties are doing this, and where the Democratic Obama administration seems to be enabling and emboldening others to do that. Now, let's talk about, a lot of people don't like to come down hard on religion. However, though, I mean, I was theologically based youth, and none of this has to do with the real fundamentals of religion.
Right.
Let's talk about Feminists for Life, Women Who Regret Their Abortions, and BlackGenocide.org, which are some of the prominent forces in this anti-abortion group that's coming here.
Sure. Well, these people are people who, like you said, have either had an abortion and regretted it, or feel that abortion in the African-American community is considered the Darfur of America, which is preposterous. I mean, the people that are dying in Darfur they're born, first of all, and, they're being terrorized by people.
And they're truly suffering.
They're truly suffering, exactly. And, that's really not relevant to abortion at all. I think what these people are doing are taking their own personal experiences and trying to make sure everyone feels the same way they do by limiting access. You know, it's like they're not really putting themselves in the shoes of a woman who is desperate, in the shoes of a woman who needs an abortion, and they're just...
Or even the shoes of a woman who wants abortion. Sort of the flip side to these groups that are religious and anti-choice are groups like Catholics for Choice, are people who are religious but understand that abortion is a choice that they may not make, but someone else will make. And they understand that people need access to a safe, legal abortion if they need one. So there's definitely a flip side. When we talk about religion, I think the loud voices are usually anti-choice voices when it comes to religion. But there's plenty of people who are religious and who are spiritual who believe that every person has the inherent right to make that choice for themselves. So, yeah, we really need to get those people's voices out there and sort of understand that people who are aggressive and who don't want choice are coming from their own personal beliefs or are coming from their own mindset and sort of suggesting religion is the cause when really it isn't.
Talk about the supply of abortion right now. How many counties across the country, and it's similar in this liberal California as across the country. How much abortion really is there?
Well, abortion rates have been declining. They recently, actually, can we pause really quick? All right, let me read into that question.
No recorder.
Okay. Yes, in response to your question, 87% of U.S. counties don't have an abortion provider. I believe in Georgia there's something like one or two abortion providers in the entire state. Coupled with that, women, you just mentioned some laws that were put out there where women have to get an ultrasound before they can have an abortion. The crazy thing about this is you get an ultrasound, 24 hours later you have to come back, and then if you want to get the abortion, you can. That's not true in all cases, but I know certainly in some clinics they're required to do that by law. So the hardship is if somebody lives in, say, an area where they don't have an abortion provider, they have to travel, 100 miles to get to the clinic, they have to get an ultrasound, 24 hours later they have to come back for an abortion. So it's all this added expense of a hotel, of a car. So it's really incredibly inconvenient and traumatic, So anyhow.
The 24 and 48 hour waiting periods.
Exactly.
I had to run to another state for surgery one time for something that was controversial. Yeah, so that would mean not only they can't make their decision ahead of time, they've got to take 24 to 48 hours to reconsider it, but that would mean holding up in a hotel room.
Right, and there's no subsidy for that. I mean, if you're required to have an ultrasound, it seems like they ought to then subsidize. If you walk in knowing that you want that choice, that you've already made that choice, it doesn't seem fair that they're forcing you to wait, especially when there's really no waiting period to get drugs like Viagra, which actually increase pregnancy rates and that kind of thing. It's a really strange culture, I think, that we're in right now, where it feels like certain agendas are being pushed when they're just completely ridiculous. I mean, healthcare covers these kinds of like Viagra drugs, but it's difficult to get Plan B at a pharmacy if you are, getting help from the state to get paid for it. And in the military, it's the same issue. Women are literally, they can't get abortions. They can't pay for an abortion with their own money in the military. It's effectively a ban.
Mm-hmm. Right. A couple of more things here. I'm getting away from the group themselves. But right now, within the last week, U.S. Representative Mike Pence hopes to reduce the number of abortions performed by Planned Parenthood by denying federal funding to the organization. He's not trying to lower federal funding for abortions, but to basically punish any of the organizations that do other reproductive rights services that they, if they do abortions, they can't have their funding. So
right.
basically trying to put Planned Parenthood
right.
out of business. What kind of a climate is that creating?
Well, that's pretty wild because the bulk of the work that Planned Parenthood does is preventative work. They do a lot of education programs with teenagers, with immigrant communities, and with young couples where they talk not only about, you know, STDs, about preventing pregnancy, but they talk about healthy relationships and how to have a good, strong relationship, how to treat each other. They do quite a bit of work that's preventative. So they do offer abortion services, but it's comprehensive. They do health screenings, they do annual exams, and they do counseling.
Yeah, and I think it's really creating a climate where women feel like they are on the chopping block. I mean, it's really not about respecting choice. It's not about respecting privacy at all. It's basically forcing people, you know, this gentleman is, you know, forcing his agenda on people and effectively, you know, leaving a lot of women out in the cold if he's trying to defund Planned Parenthood.
And just to kind of jump on and add into that, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was recently passed, which is a really great celebration for gay and lesbian.
Repealed.
I'm sorry, what did I say? Pass? I'm sorry, yeah. You'll fix that.
Repealed.
Repealed.
Go right ahead.
I'm sorry. Don't Ask, Don't Tell was recently repealed. One of the reasons that it was repealed, there was a suggestion, you know, there was a suggestion put out there that women need to have access to abortions if they're serving in the military overseas. Unfortunately, the Congress didn't go for that, and so they went for Don't Ask.
Yeah, so basically, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed, which is great news, but in that bill, there was also a provision that would repeal the current abortion ban in the military. And that was taken out, and then the repeal was passed. So it's really, you see a lot of groups, it feels like we're trading one group's rights for another, and that's just ridiculous. We really need to be working together to make sure we all get, you know, the freedoms that we deserve.
So what you're saying is something that popular forces said had to be repealed was used to quietly strike at abortion, just like the healthcare bill.
Absolutely,
said.
Exactly.
What will a woman in the military, who's overseas, do now?
Well, women in the military overseas have never had the right to have an abortion on base. They can't federally, federally it's not covered, and they can't pay for an abortion with their own money. They're prevented from doing even that, which is wild, considering the amount of sexual assault that happens in the military. So basically, it's status quo for women. So BayCor is also very active in changing policies, so that's one of the things that we're really looking at, too.
Great. And one more for the religious right. You can read you could read this one. I've read it so many times, but Reverend Clenard H. Childress has been the chief spokesperson for this Walk for Life for a number of years. I'd have to say probably one of the handful of African-American people out of the thousands or tens of thousands that are out there. He's got a website called blackgenocide.org. Read over what's on this website and how he's characterizing abortion for women overall and in the black community.
Sure. So he is taking existing statistics, which is basically for every two African-American women that get pregnant, one will choose to abort. A black baby is 5 times more time to be killed in the womb than a white baby. And he's taking this to believe that there is some sort of genocide happening in the African-American community against fetuses. One of his quotes is, "The most dangerous place for an African-American is to be in the womb of their African-American mother."
It would be interesting to wonder whether Reverend Childress is doing a lot of work in prevention, making sure everyone has access to contraceptives, and making sure that there are people who can effectively raise children. That seems like that would be a much stronger way to go about preventing abortion, if that's sort of his intent, than to suggest there's a huge conspiracy against black fetuses.
Yeah, it looks like he's making the claim by putting down a quote from Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and her quote is, "Frankly, I had thought that at the time Roe was decided, there was concern about population growth, and particularly growth in populations that we don't want to have too many of." And he seems to be insinuating that the African-American community is a community that we don't want more of, and hence this black genocide. I think nothing could be farther from the truth. That's absolutely ridiculous. He's just using really inflammatory language to get people
riled up about this information. And
this one.
Yeah, and again, this quote, the most dangerous place for an African-American to be is in the womb of their African-American mother. And what he's really taking out of the equation is the mother. He's not thinking that these women are people who have, you know, choice. They're not, he's not considering that, you know, they have a life they want to live and this is their decision.
Right, and are they in a climate where they can raise a baby, they can give a baby, you know, the life that they want to give them? Where is the consideration for the parent?
Yeah, right, exactly.
To hear him say this, because I have heard him in front of thousands of people, but that's my point of the whole thing, is he seems to be saying that because African American women are choosing to do this,
right,
we need the government to ban their choice.
Yeah, that's exactly.
So that, because they can't think for themselves. Does that sound?
That sounds pretty much what he's saying, and nothing can be a worse solution than that. Yeah.
Right. Let's take it in a more constructive vein. Bacor is talking about not just abortion, but full reproductive rights and some other things. Why don't you talk about Bacor's agenda?
Sure. So Bacor's agenda is really about obviously supporting abortion, supporting women, and supporting larger access to reproductive rights. A lot of women who work at women's health clinics and men that work at clinics that offer services for women for reproductive rights are involved in Bacor. And when we started this organization, we were also more active in protecting clinics that offer reproductive rights.
When we first started, Summer mentioned Operation Rescue was in effect, and that's basically a ginormous anti-choice movement. The leader is Randall Terry, who, interestingly enough, the new Speaker of the House's staff met with him. Randall Terry called for the murder of George. I'm sorry, he didn't call for it. He applauded the murder of George Tiller, which is crazy. So that's kind of more of the political climate. But on a constructive note, yeah, Bacor was there to protect women who were going into clinics. They were there as a presence of support. And that's some of the work that we've done in the past. And so basically, yeah, we're just, we partner with a couple different groups. Recently, a coalition got together and they started the Silver Ribbon to Trust Women campaign, and that lasts from January 22nd to February 22nd, and it's basically just talking to your friends, talking to your family about the reproductive, talking to friends and family just about the challenges that women face when it comes to reproductive health and how we need to be really proactive in making sure that each woman has access.
So it's really calling attention to the campaign and getting people talking about it. We also do some grassroots events. Last night we went out and went on a pub crawl, which, you know, it's not something we do often, but you know, we handed out condoms and promoted reproductive health
and promoted the parade that we're having.
Right. Now the anti-abortion forces can get a lot more mainstream support than us, because if you look at their whole political agenda, and especially the church-based people, they will follow a hard Republican agenda just for this issue. Pro-war, anti-immigration, anti-LGBT, anti-single-payer health, anti-feminism. No good. Now, there's a lot of... This battle here on the event of Walk for Life is much more of a David and Goliath fight in terms of the numbers,
right,
than the overall views of the public are.
Sure.
In that there's a lot of dissent in the pro-abortion forces around this event and around street actions.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about what the challenges are to meet the right head on the streets,
okay,
you know, amongst pro-abortion groups of people, and what's being done for effective organizing for this event in light of that.
Sure. Well, I think a lot of people have the feeling that, you know, pro-choice is the status quo. You know, abortion is legal and women can get abortions. But, you know, as we've discussed today, there are a lot of ways that access is being restricted. And, you know, a lot of people don't really know that. And so they think, okay, you know, abortion is legal, abortion is safe, we don't have to come out to these events, we don't have to mobilize, and we don't have to be vocal. But we do. I think that because it's San Francisco and it's such a liberal city, people feel like it's sort of redundant to come out for a pro-choice event because San Francisco is a pretty pro-choice city. But I think what we're really trying to do with this event is to get people together and get people mobilized and also to meet fellow people that are active in the pro-choice community and also show that this, you know, show this pro-life contingency that they're in the minority. They're the ones that actually don't have the will of, you know, most of America on their side. And I can understand where some people in the pro-choice camp aren't interested in the direct actions. They aren't maybe interested in walking next to someone who's holding a pro-life sign, and they aren't maybe comfortable out there, you know, with that sort of atmosphere. But I just would welcome everyone to come out because you don't have to go out there and scream in somebody's face. You don't have to go out there and yell. You just really come out there and walk for your beliefs. That's basically what we're doing. We're going out there to walk for our beliefs and to be a presence and to be a voice for the pro-choice community.
Right. Talk about Planned Parenthood and the established abortion providers. How has it been trying to coalesce with them around these type of events?
Well, I think that they tend, you know, they are facing a lot of problems from the federal government. They have more diplomacy that they really need to be aware of. So we completely respect that. And people within the BayCorp coalition work at different community clinics or volunteer their time for different community clinics. So we're completely respectful of the fact that people might need to be, you know, kind of more low profile or, you know, have connections where they want to just keep it as non-confrontational as possible. So we understand that. But as individuals and as people who, you know, are pro-choice, we welcome everybody to come out there. People don't have to come out in sort of a, you know, with an organization. You can just come out individually. Right.
Right. In other words, the fact that they have to rely on funding
sure.
and constantly lobby Democratic Party
yes.
politicians to keep that funding
yeah.
and could easily, the way these NGOs are structured,
sure.
They can't lobby for law publicly.
Right.
It doesn't keep their employees from doing this, but there's always a chilling effect in
right.
that year-to-year funding, and it's so tenuous that,
right,
you know,
exactly. And I hate to imply that what we're doing is negative, but because it isn't. You know, what we're doing is we're out there, we're a voice for the pro-choice community, and it's not a negative situation, but I think it can be interpreted that way by people who really are anti-choice. Well, I was going to say by lawmakers who are worried about their own public image. So, you know, if, I think there's just a lot of politics that can get involved that really don't have anything to do with us or with Planned Parenthood, but it's just the people that we're interacting with. So,
right. Let's wrap up. What else is there that you'd want to say about the event and to people to get the word out? We still have a week to go.
We do. I would like to just tell people that Saturday, January 22nd, is the anniversary of the ruling of Roe v. Wade, which, of course, made abortion legal for every woman in the United States. And we're going to go out there and we're going to celebrate that right. We're going to be a presence for the pro-choice community in San Francisco. We're meeting at 11 o'clock at the Harry Bridges Plaza, which is the median strip in front of the Ferry Building. So we're meeting there at 11. We're going to have all kinds of people. Some of the organizations that are coming so far are Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, San Francisco Women Against Rape. We've got the Trust Women community who is going to be out there, and I believe Law Students for Choice, as well as a bevy of other people that we just haven't confirmed yet. But anyhow, we're all going to be out there. We're meeting at 11. We're marching at noon, and it's going to last till about 2:30. So we encourage everybody to come out and bring a friend, bring a creative sign, and if anybody wants to do any kind of demonstrations, they're more than welcome to.
Yeah, and some other groups involved are Radical Women, and Cindy Sheehan will also be there at the rally.
And Raging Grannies.
Raging Grannies, and it's going to be a really creative event. You know, it's really fun, and everyone always has a good time.
Right. Okay, thanks for interviewing, and we'll be out there.
Thank you.
Thank you.